in your beautiful heaven, Lord.
That whole song is a prayer. Becky Buller, Make Us to Shine. 9 minutes after the hour, that's after 8 o'clock here in our central time zone of East Dakota. And I'm Jim Park. David Allen Punt is with us. Joining us now from Garden Valley, Texas, is our own Dr. Don Clark. He's our staff biochemist and member of the Board of Creation Moments. Don, happy Tuesday. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave.
We're battling internet problems this morning, apparently.
So. I guess Dave is... I don't see him, but he's there. Maybe he's not.
He's here.
Okay.
But he's holding his voice down because the internet is having trouble.
That's true. Yeah. Well, we're going to go as long as we can with Don this morning. But if it gets too bad here, we'll just have to go back to music. It's doing unpredictable things for us today. But Don, you're approaching the beginning of the real summer down there in Texas now. Does that change your day-to-day duties with the wine, with the grapes?
Oh, with being outside, yeah. For sure. Mm-hmm. It's starting to get quite warm, actually. Mm-hmm. We had this week, or last week, was the warmest we've had since the beginning of the year. And this week is turning out to be the same, or it might even get a little bit warmer.
When do you start harvesting? Like September, August?
It would, the whites, no, our whites will harvest in June.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in July.
Okay.
And our reds would be in August sometime.
Okay. You brought something in last week, or were you bottling something?
I brought...
Weren't you harvesting or bottling or something?
Oh no! We were going to bottle, and then we didn't get our labels, so we put that off. We'll probably go ahead and bottle this week. The plan is to start bottling on tomorrow, and then hopefully finish up on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be the end of our major bottling. Then we'll have I've got some smaller quantities of wine that I need to bottle as well.
This could be interesting reality radio here. We could do the life of the vineyard on day to day here.
I just have a camera in the winery and
see
the operations as it happens.
You'd be big on slow TV out in Norway way.
It would be. It's a lot of repetitive work when it comes to bottling and labeling
I picture you in your white lab coat and test tubes and little measuring devices and a Bunsen burner, just putting together these wines. That's probably not an accurate picture, though, huh? I mean, you probably don't have a white lab coat.
No, well, actually, I don't have a white lab coat.
Well, we need
I
to get you
a white lab coat when I'm doing lab. But no white lab coat, unfortunately. It's just me in my shorts and just going after it. But the trick to making wine, I mean, there's a lot of a lot of things that one does, obviously. But you got to have a picture in your mind about what type of wine you want to make. I mean, are you going out to make a sweet wine that's very fruity, or are you going to make a bold wine, for example, that's completely dry? Mm-hmm. And so you even at the point of fermentation, the first couple of steps, you're making those decisions because the temperature, for example, at which you ferment at will determine whether it's a strong bold wine or whether it's a lighter fruity wine.
Okay, so would you call this a creative occupation?
Oh, it is. Yes, it's both scientific and both.
I mean, besides wining, besides writing wine descriptors, there's something creative to this then.
Oh, very much
well,
so.
The making of the
very
wine,
yeah. So. And then you're making decisions all the way mm-hmm. down. I mean, even before we bottled, you have to make a decision. Well, am I going to add a little sugar to this, or mm-hmm. I'm not going to add a little sugar? I'm going to add a little of this. Am I going to adjust the pH a little bit?
Do you do that by taste, or do you do that by some sort of a chemical analysis? No, when you taste it, say, "Well, no, it should be a little sweeter."
Yeah, no, but adding the sugar is more by taste.
Mm-hmm.
Does the sugar, help? Adjusting the pH, of course, is mm-hmm. both analytical and by taste because your numbers could say, oh, you know, I want to drop this white wine down, for example, to 3.2. But mm-hmm. when you do that, you find out that, wow, this is too acidic. And so
what do you add to alter the pH of wine? I mean, just wondering what's in your spice rack there for the wines.
Oh, tartaric acid.
Okay.
Is the main ingredient. I mean, you can add a blend of acids like tartaric or citric and citric, but typically it's just tartaric acid, and that can bring the pH down.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes your wines are too acidic, and then you got to bring the pH up.
And what do you do then? What do you put in then? You put in some alkaline.
You can put in the potassium carbonate, potassium bicarbonate.
See, really does take a biochemist to do this. Then you got to
So you got to have a little bit of chemistry. If you don't have chemistry, you're out of luck. Mm-hmm. Really.
We were on the road over the weekend, and we came across my wife was looking for a sweet wine, and we found a German. German Riesling, and she wanted to know if it was sweet or if it was good. And I looked at the back of the label and could tell there's Qualitätswein mit Prädikat was one of the better wines that, you know, according to the German wine industry. Is there anything on your label that will give consumers an idea of whether or not this is sweet like honey, or nice and dry and crisp like Sauvignon Blanc? Or we just have to get lucky and try one.
Well, no, my Moscato, for example, I put on the back label that it's a sweet wine.
Okay.
Sometimes the label will have something on it that will say semi-dry or sweet, but it's not mandatory from the labeling point of view that you do that, and certainly the concentration of sugar is not mandatory to put on the label. So you wind up just a characteristic type of wine. I mean, Rieslings you'd normally think as being a little bit sweeter, but not probably as sweet as the Moscato, for example. Mm-hmm. Our Moscato was about 4%, sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet is typically classified between 3 to 5% or even higher sugar, and semi-dry is between 1 to 3%.
You should have like a little scale on the back of your wines then, with that, because those words you use, semi-sweet, semi-dry, would mean different things to different people.
Yes, they would, but it is somewhat standardized. And you can look it up and say, you know, what's a semi-dry wine, and you'll find, you know, a percentage range of concentration of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other ingredients that you can add to the wine that can make it taste sweet, and it would have absolutely no alcohol in it. Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Some of the winemaking ingredients kind of smooth things out, and you say, oh, this looks tastes a little sweet, and there's absolutely no sugar. You know, it's been fermented.
That's why you need that scale on there. I need a wine app, apparently. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've got one, come to think of it.
Well, I'm wondering if there isn't a market out there for a taste sensor that you can add to your iPhone. That you hold it up over the glass.
Sealed bottle, I don't know.
And you hold it up over the glass, and it reacts to the pheromones or some sort of
a little audio signal like.
Yeah, or it gives you a sliding scale because, mm-hmm. I worked in retail for a while and I've done a little bit of tasting and I guess my criticism of the American wine industry is that there really isn't any way to know from bottle to bottle to bottle to company to whatever, you know, if the wine is sweet exactly like a Tootsie Roll Pop or sweet exactly like, honey is a good example, mm-hmm. or clover honey. There's different sweetnesses there. And in many cases, you can't tell if the wine is sweet or at all.
And you want to risk $7.99 on a bottle if you're.
Well, yeah, how sweet guys like Jim, they're willing to go up to like $8.50 for a bottle of wine.
I've been known to 10, $11 bucks sometimes.
Don't come down to Texas.
If it's a special occasion, I'll go whole hog, and it could be 12.
I think I was going to say there was a special occasion. You went 12 last time.
That's true.
I was just like, whoa. Well, whoa.
It was her birthday. I wanted something special.
All right. But it's, and that's the difficulty. I mean, people with, do wine tasting or into selling wine, and many times clerks don't know anything. I mean, they, their last job was selling tires. So they know that if they sell a bottle at $40 as opposed to one at $6.50, the boss is going to be happier when you sell more than $40 wines. But, what the wines taste like, most of them don't.
This wine has excellent traction, they would say. Okay.
Your experience is the same.
A bottle that is, $7 or $8, you can certainly take a chance and say, am I going to like this or not? And if you like it, then you've got a good, hit a gold mine. But if you don't like it, you want to step up a little bit in your in the pricing.
But living dangerously is just me. What can I tell you?
But price doesn't necessarily reflect, the quality of wine. Although, obviously when you get up to the $50 or $100 bottle of wine, that you would expect it to be a little better.
Likewise, if you get under $4, you can expect something else altogether. So, okay. two billion heartbeats in a lifetime. I think I want to start. I wonder where I am in that. See, if you have a pulse rate of 60, which is, I guess, kind of average, 60 to 70. That was 60 times 60. That's 360 beats in an hour. No, minute. Wait a minute. 60 times 60 is 3,600 in an hour. I can't even do the math. But 2 billion, hopefully that'll last me a while. But the question we're dealing with today is, and this is in an article from the publication Behemoth, when does the first one happen and how and why? And this is a fascinating article. It's called Mysteries of a Beating Heart here, and it has to do with what triggers the first beat of a heart. And in fact, it didn't even look like a heart at this point. Don, what insights can you give us here? Hopefully you've had a chance to analyze this article. This is a little complicated.
Well, it's interesting because the article, winds up saying no one knows what causes it, other than it's an exchange of ions, potassium and sodium ions in the cell, and your first heart cells, for example, it actually forms a little tube, and the tube. After, I guess, it gets a little, a certain size, some of the cells begin to fire.
And this is
apparently every cell has the ability to fire, but the cells kind of just start by randomly firing, and then things get a little bit more coordinated. And eventually it winds up that a certain cluster of cells, which we know as the pacemaker, our natural pacemaker in our heart, wind up taking control of that particular job, and then that stimulates.
It's almost like one cell steps up and takes charge, which is another miracle here. Let me read a couple sentences from the beginning of this. We still don't know how it begins, but suddenly it moves. At some point around the 22nd day of an embryo's life, there will be a flicker. And then another, and another. A cylinder of tissue which had never moved before suddenly oscillates. Random bursts of activity occur throughout each jolt sparked by a puff of ions. They trigger a wave across the surface that gives it the appearance of a pond rippling in the rain. As the embryo grows, the activity will organize and the cylinder will balloon out and fold up into something that looks less like a tube and more like a heart. And this is the beginning of those 2 billion beats that will sustain you over a lifetime. Figure electrical potential, maybe? It's got to be like a short, like a capacitor that has to discharge.
Well, I mean, there is a buildup. You've got ion pumps, for example. in certain types of cells, and this the heart cells certainly have a lot of iron pumps. Calcium is responsible. The movement of calcium into any muscle cell causes it to contract, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you have channels in the membranes of these cells that pump potassium and sodium in certain directions, and when the cell discharges, the ions, you know, move in the opposite direction very, very quickly. It's the same kind of principle that you get the nerve cells to fire, because that involves these very similar, you know, pumps, ion pumps. But how does this, you know, it's a chemical change, you know, within the cell that mimics an electrical pulse, if you will.
Well, except that I think it's real electricity. I don't know if it mimics it. It's like electrochemical. It's electricity from chemicals.
Yeah, but not in the sense that you would necessarily, you know, have in a wire, copper wire, for example.
How about like a magnetic field kind of thing?
Well, it does, because you have ion exchange. You do have, you can measure its electrical potential, and mm-hmm. obviously you'd get an electrocardiogram. It's they've got electrodes all over you, mm-hmm. Measuring the discharge and the pulses. That actually take place. So it turns into an electrical signal, if you will. Same with our nerves. So it's a bioelectrical type of mechanism, which is an interesting design feature, because we've been trying to mimic what God has created for years. And it seems like, God's creation seems to be very, very efficient, for one thing. And it just is amazing what cells, decide that, hey, I'm going to be the pacemaker, and we're going to take charge of this.
Mm-hmm.
We have absolutely no idea as to why that happens or why it should happen. we barely understand why a cell begins to differentiate. I mean, you think of it, when the egg gets fertilized by a sperm, you have one cell. You have one cell that's totally undifferentiated at that point. And then it divides into two cells, and then four cells, and then eight cells, mm-hmm. and, keeps doubling. And it doesn't take very long before you have this pumping tube. And you begin to, see little fingers form, and a little head, and a little spinal cord is forming. I mean, what does that? It's like, is there something outside this that is controlling this? What causes these various cells to start to differentiate and to form a heart? It's interesting, because a lot of even in poetry and in literature, you it talks about various you got a heart problem, heart problem meaning an emotional type of problem,
yeah.
not a mechanical problem with your heart. I mean, you may have a mechanical problem with your heart, but it's referring to some type of emotional problem.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the Bible, if you just do a word search on heart, you find all kinds of references to guard your heart, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or out of the, out of your heart, not out of your mind. You would think that, your evil thoughts and all of this and what's in your mind causes you to speak negatively or positively. But the terminology is out of your heart.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we've talked about some recent brain research that indicates that thoughts do not originate in the brain. So you talk about the head and the heart and how the two need to be together to make an important decision. And if they're in opposition, you might want to think twice about doing that or becoming that or going there. It's almost like the two need to be working in concert for good things to happen. I mean, there's something to this thing, heart. And whether or not it's your physical heart, we've connected the concept of heart, that is something that's with us, that's so close, such an integral part of us, that it's part of our language. You know, we talk about the beating of the heart and be still my heart and as long as my heart beats. And, you know, we connected the heart with life itself, and it's certainly that physical connection, but maybe it's more than that, do you think?
Oh, I very much think that it's more than that, because those, you know, folks that have had heart surgery, for example, they've had a heart replacement. Their heart wears out, and they find a match and replace the person's heart. Sometimes the person's personality changes when they get a new heart. And they find out, well, you know, the heart that you had was from an evil person. And so now this person is disturbed. They're not at peace because the heart from the individual that died wasn't at peace, for example. So it's interesting because the heart has some interesting parallels to the throne room of God, which we often don't necessarily think about. We know, for example, in Genesis, the latter part of chapter 1 of Genesis, it says, "Let us make man in our own image, in the image of God. Let us make male, mm-hmm. Male and female." So we are made in God's image. But sometimes we just don't appreciate that perhaps our bodies is a earthly representation of the throne room. Now, I'm going to explain this a little bit. We're going through in church. I'm teaching a series in Revelation, and there's many, many references to the throne room, and the references are always kind of the same. It's like there's thundering, and there's lightning, and there's noise, there's all of this activity, going on, flashes of lightning. And then there's four living creatures that are around the throne. Around them are 24 elders. Well, isn't it interesting that the heart is made up of four chambers? And isn't it interesting that when you put an electrode on your chest, you can actually measure what sounds like maybe, hey, you know, this could be like thunder.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the sound of the throne room. Now, we can, walking and talking to a person, you can't hear their thunder and they can't hear your thunder. But once we have the instruments to magnify the sound, you would say, hey, that's interesting. I wonder if the throne room is like this.
Mm-hmm.
You get that picture from, Ezekiel and other places that talk about the throne room, like I said, in Revelation.
And isn't it true that infants, when you hold them, especially when their mother holds them, that they're kind of reconnected to that heartbeat, that they find that soothing and comforting? Just, yes. I mean, just the sound of their mother's heart.
So the closer, I mean, yeah, they've been listening to it, mm-hmm. For 9 months or ever since they, got the sense of hearing, which, of mm-hmm. course, they do in the womb, at a certain point. You've got that. Then you have these arteries around the top of the heart that is crowning the heart. And these arteries are called coronary arteries. Hmm. And the reason why they're called coronary arteries, because coronary means crown.
Yeah.
So you've got, you have your crown around, you know, around your heart. And, you know, your chambers, you know, beat, they take in, for example, the spent blood, that's, you know, full of carbon dioxide, or burnt, if you will, because when you burn, you know, when you burn wood or burn something, it produces carbon dioxide. And so when we breathe, we take in oxygen and we exchange the oxygen, you know, for carbon dioxide, or we exchange the carbon dioxide for oxygen. But that process begins in the heart. Because it takes the spent blood, or the dead blood, if you will,
mm-hmm.
or the burnt blood, it pumps it in one set of channels, and then it goes up to the lungs, and then that comes back and gets pumped through the other pair of chambers in mm-hmm. your heart. And that gets pumped, you know, to the rest of your your body.
Reoxygenated, yeah.
So you get new life. You know, you're getting new life from the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go from a dead state to a life state by doing what? By taking a breath. You know, it's like God is continually breathing into mm-hmm. us. Of course, we're doing the breathing now, but... Mm-hmm. You know, you could imagine that God, you know, breathing that first breath of life, you know, into us. And we have a reminder every time we take a breath of God's saving and living breath of life that we have. So, you know, the heart is an amazing thing. And, of course, there's a lot of electrical activity, as you mm-hmm. kind of mentioned. Electrical in a different sense than we, you know, like I said, the mechanics are a little different. Even so, there's all this electrical activity. So is there a memory in the heart? And does your heart somehow, when a person, you know, we know, for example, that, in Isaiah 61, it talks about binding up the brokenhearted. Well, you know, how do you get your heart broken? Obviously, it's not your physical heart, but how do you get your heart broken? Well, you get your heart broken when somebody you thought should have loved you didn't love you, and your heart breaks. Well, does something physically happen to your own heart at that point in time? Is your own heart kind of weakened, or is there some memory in your heart that is like deep within you that kind of controls your emotions and your thinking and your mind, and it starts you in a certain path, for example, which is not positive. It either leads you down into depression, or it starts you in a path that says, you know, nobody loves me, and so I'm not going to love anybody else. And then you only start thinking about yourself, and it makes you into a very selfish person.
Mm-hmm.
Does that reside in the heart? I mean, it's hard to fathom, because we spend so much time with this organ we call the brain and all the electrical impulses that are in the brain, and we know that, you know, there's memory in brain and all this other stuff, and we figure that out. But, you know, we haven't spent any time with the heart.
Well, we don't really stop to, you know, we think of where physically in our body, and if actually we're talking spirit here, maybe place is irrelevant. I mean, physical place is irrelevant. This is not something that we enclose within our bodies, but it's something spiritual that could be anywhere, or could be everywhere. I mean,
it could be, But God designed it. I mean, I firmly believe that he designed it to look like the throne room.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that may be that's our center of our being, which, mm-hmm. of course, would be our spirit or soul, if you will, would be the center. So you've got this beating heart in the center with four chambers around it, and there's all this electrical activity. And then around the throne room, you have 24 elders. Well, you've got 24 ribs around the throne room, 12 on one side and 12 on the other side.
Hmm.
So, I mean, why 24? You know, it's like, this is weird.
Mm-hmm.
This is more than
just the point.
A coincidence.
Well, it is more than a coincidence, and we're surrounded with things inside our bodies and out that mimic or that parallel the spiritual counterpart. Which is primal, which is first, because we're derived, we're created by spirit, and that's what the Bible teaches us. And every time we look around, including at the human heart, we see lessons in that, ties in that illustrate very clearly where we came from. And it seems a dastardly thing to do to deny those clues. And I think you've got something here. I've never heard it explained that way.
Well, it's if we begin to look at if you start from the premise that okay, God created everything, and if you take His word at His word that is we are made in His image, God the Father resides at throne room.
Mm-hmm.
In the throne room.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got these four living creatures around him. And then you begin to explore, the similarities. I mean, if, for example, in chapter 2 in Genesis, chapter 2 is a earthly representation of the throne room as well. Because there's these four rushing rivers that are coming out of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, are you kidding me? Why four? And it names the rivers. One of them is the Euphrates, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that Euphrates is a very important river that is kind of the seat of man's civilization and culture. And it's the beginning of man's civilization, and it will be the end of man's civilization, mm-hmm. interestingly enough. But, why did God design it that way? Well, again, it's a representation of the throne room.
Mm-hmm.
So if you then take what we know of the throne room and you begin to read chapter 2 of Genesis, you get a whole new picture. It's like God is wanting to be so close to us that he is mimicking his house, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
He's mimicked it, first of all, with us, our human bodies. Then he's mimicking it, says, look, I'm going to place you in the garden, which is going to look like my throne room.
Mm.
Here it is. And it's going to sound like my throne room.
Patterns over and over and over.
Yeah, I love you so much, and I'm going to come visit you, mm-hmm. so that when I come to your house, it's going to look like my house.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just awesome. It's awesome.
It is awesome. And this is, the patterns are all around us. And I don't know how long it took for us to figure this out about the heart. I'm wondering if the ancients had this knowledge as well and made the same connections. But this article in Behemoth is fascinating. And again, it has to do with that first heartbeat. What determines when it happens? And I'll tell you what, I'm going to put the link to this in our chat window here at Broken Road Radio. Let me see if I can do it right now. Well, it's not going to do it. Let me try it one more time.
Don, I've got a question. The you've given me an aha moment this morning, and that it's got the information that's absolutely correct and right. And as soon as you hear it, it makes inordinate sense. Did you come up with this, or is there a school of is there a group of people out there that have come up with this? Or, well, you're a very smart guy. You could have come up with this yourself. But have well, you they, have you yeah, read other actually, places?
Well, a friend of mine that I've known from years, Chuck Thurston, actually, came, but he's a medical doctor. All right, and so he's also a Christian, obviously. Mm-hmm. And he has come up. Actually, you could probably Google Chuck Thurston, he has written a book, a small book called The Body Codes. He's got a small DVD where he goes and explains not only the heart, but the ribs, the clavicle, two keys, the clavicle. The word clavicle, for example, means little key. And it's interesting that we have one key on our right shoulder and one key on our left shoulder. And it's like we've got the keys, we've got the mm-hmm. keys to life, mm-hmm. if you will. he goes through this in his little booklet or in his DVD called The Body Codes. Mm-hmm. And, you can search for that. But he's the one that I first heard this from, and he's the one that's kind of put it together from his medical experience. Mm-hmm. He's listening to heartbeats all the time.
Sure,
right. And that's one of the first things you do. Well, how to check the heart, see how the person's doing. We check the heartbeat. Does it look normal, or is it irregular, or did you miss a beat? Are you missing a beat often? You have a condition called arrhythmia that could be deleterious to your health eventually. And then some people just their control system just breaks down. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything is fine, and then all of a sudden it stops. Well, if you're your control system, breaks down, you're in trouble. I mean, the heart could be perfectly normal, but, without a pacemaker, it's not doing much. So you definitely need the pacemaker. But, yeah, I would point folks to him and to – let me see if I can find his website. I probably have it in my contacts.
If you just Google Chuck Thurston, you get a whole bunch of contacts or a whole bunch of – other references. And body codes, throne rooms, walking. Body codes actually looks like a series whether it's a series of videos or a series of interviews or exactly, I'm not sure, but there's a YouTube video of him mm-hmm. talking to David Rivas on TBN. Not sure mm-hmm. what it is. But
he gives his presentation on that mm-hmm. on that particular one.
Ha! Huh, interesting.
The human body is an incredible thing.
Hang on, I'm sorry.
More than just a comp.
I just went to his YouTube video.
There he is, right there.
There he is. And ask and ye shall receive. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm going to put that link in the window as well here.
And one of the other things that I was thinking about is. Then we've always, maybe I'm the only one that's ever experienced heartbreak, but I think everybody has. And, as a teenager and the girl you wanted to go to the prom with said, no way, Jose, go with you. Are you kidding me? And, for hours or days, my chest hurt. And, what is the meaning of that? Maybe there's some sort of emotional connection to the heart muscles, or?
Well, there is. I believe that it is a seat of our being. Mm. And emotions are certainly involved with it. But I think there's a physical, is more than just emotions. Because what are our emotions really driven by? you know, it's like, well, they're driven by our feelings. Well, you know, what are feelings? Mm. You start asking these questions, you come up blank. Uh-huh. You say, what? Where does all this stuff originate from? And eventually you have to come down to, it's the essence of our being, which is, you know, got to be our spirit. You know, got to involve our spirit. And there's this interface between our spirit and our bodies, which is called the soul. And so when the spirit is crushed, as in a broken relationship of some sort, that affects the soul, which then affects the body. And maybe the connection point between the soul and the body, for example, starts off in the heart. Hmm. And then kind of radiates from there.
Interesting concept.
So, connecting all this stuff, how do you connect the non-physical with the physical? I mean, what instrument are you going to use to measure that? I mean, we don't have anything.
The mind is symbolic of that, because you get an idea. Let's say you're an engineer. You get an idea. You have a problem you want to solve. You get an idea for how to do it. Something has to convert it from an idea to something tangible and real. And so you draw a picture of it, or you simply provide a description of what was in your mind, and then someone else can act on that and build one. You know, your mind is like a conversion engine from something non-tangible to something tangible. I mean, and so, to me, it's there, and the heart could well play a huge part in that as well, especially when there are feelings and emotions added into the mix. But, if you want to build an airplane, it took us a while to design it, but we had the concept first in somebody's head. This is how a wing works. And so you distill the mathematics out of it, and then you engineer it, and you build it, and voila, you've got something that was purely an idea, and now it's a physical reality. And that comes from the human brain. It's an amazing thing.
Or does it? I mean, where does the first thought come from? Mm-hmm. In the first place.
Yeah, and science tends to think it's outside the brain. Yeah.
Did it come from our brain? Our mm-hmm. brains are mechanical. Yeah. I mean, they're electrical mechanical, but they're mechanical. But where did that first thought come from?
Mm-hmm. And is it given to us? Is it a gift?
Yeah,
is it given to us? Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, because we know that God can give us thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that the enemy can give us thoughts. So
yeah.
he can prod us into a certain direction. And mm-hmm. and God, why did he place a spirit in us? Well, he placed a spirit in us so he can communicate with us, so mm-hmm. he can have a relationship mm-hmm. with us, mm-hmm. spirit to spirit, as opposed to, you know, spirit and flesh.
Yeah.
I mean, so all of this, connection, the world is different than what we really perceive, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
looking at the heart and reading this article, you'll see a clue right there in front of your face as to how it all works together. And Dr. Don Clark, a member of the board of Creation Moments, I want to mention creationmoments.com, their website. It's a good place to go if you're interested in the science of young earth creationism in particular, but there's lots of science there, lots of good articles and videos and audio messages, creationmoments.com. Don, thanks so much for joining us again, and hopefully we'll see you again next week on next Tuesday, okay?
Okay, sounds great. Thank you, folks.
Have a terrific week.
Yeah, bye-bye. Thank you, Don.